people will stay away from a conversation about race rather than risk being called a racist or someone who is insensitive. The words of Michelle Norris. This hour, widening the conversation about race in America. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today, NPR host and special correspondent Michelle Norris will tell us about her race card project. Norris will be speaking tomorrow evening at Coe College. Then a conversation with award-winning broadcast journalist Soledad O'Brien. She'll talk about race and identity as reflected in the media. Her parents had to leave Maryland back in 1958 to get married due to that state's laws against interracial marriage. That's all coming up this hour. First, a look at the news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later in the program, broadcast journalist Soledad O'Brien. O'Brien is the 2014 Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Distinguished Lecturer at the University of Iowa. I'll talk with her about her award-winning news coverage of U.S. and global events, also about race and identity in media and society. That coming up a bit later. My first guest this hour is Michelle Norris, NPR host and special correspondent. Norris is also the creator of the Race Card Project, a project which asks people to think about their experiences, their hopes, their laments, and observations about race and identity, and write 6 words about them. It's an initiative to foster a wider conversation about race in America. It's one that she created after the publication of her 2010 family memoir, The Grace of Silence. Hi, Michelle.
Hi. It's great to be back with you.
Great to have you back on the program. I want to mention that you'll be talking about the Race Card Project at Coe College tomorrow at 7:30 in Sinclair Auditorium on the Coe College campus. Michelle, recently you looked at contemporary race relations at the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. commemorative lecture at Cornell University in New York. And it was interesting, in the speech you said, people will stay away from a conversation about race rather than risk being called a racist or someone who is insensitive. Can you talk about that quote?
Well, it's based on my experience. There are a lot of people who I have observed in conversations. You know they have something to say. They want to figure out how to merge into the conversation, but they hold back because they perceive that talking about race carries some risk to it. I know from the submissions that I've received that people are trying to figure out how to have this conversation. And one of the fears is not just revealing themselves, but in revealing themselves, they're going to be labeled with, they're hit with some kind of label. And one of the things that I do talk about is, if we want to have anything close to an honest conversation about race, you have to give people a little bit of latitude. Mm. And recognize that you might engage with someone who will make you uncomfortable, who might even offend you, who might say something that to your mind sounds boneheaded. And you have to decide if you're going to shut that down by essentially, by reprimanding them in some way, or by reminding them that what they said made you uncomfortable. And the example that I used, when I was recently at Cornell, was we were talking about some of the 6-word submissions, and one of the submissions that came in was from a young man. His 6 words were, "So, could you rap for us?" This is from a young black man. Mm-hmm. He is someone who, he thinks rap music is okay, but he also likes classical music. His one parent is a professor, the other is a diplomat. He's a tall African-American child. He's actually biracial, and he has a big afro. And when people see him, they just automatically assume that, oh, boy, he likes rap. Could you rap for us? And it just really bugged him that people would make that sort of assumption that that's all they saw. And he had to decide whether he was going to chastise them for this or use it as a teachable moment. I'm like, why would you ask me that? Of all the things, that you could ask me about, we're here in an educational environment. That's the only thing you could ask me about. And to figure out how to do that in a way that he could keep the dialogue going so they would leave that and maybe learn from that encounter, as opposed to leave that encounter and know how upset they made him but not really understand why. And that's just an example.
Right. There are lots of examples. And I was just scanning the Race Card Project website, and it's really fun to go through people's race cards. But tell us, for those who don't know, or remind us how the Race Card Project works.
Well, I asked people, I wrote a book, as you referenced, about my family's, it was family memoirs of my family's rather complex racial legacy, and I knew when I went out to talk about it that I would be engaging in a conversation about race as I traveled around the country. And to try to make that conversation a little bit more comfortable, I invited people to engage in an exercise where they shared their thoughts about race, their observations, their experiences, their triumphs, their laments, their anthem, in just six words. And that's how the Race Card Project began. Over time, it has morphed into almost like a sounding board. I have a website, theracecardproject.com, where I post hundreds of these submissions, and we update them all the time, and you're allowed to both observe and comment. But if you've spent time on the site, you notice that it starts with six words, but most people now send in their six words, and then they keep going.
Mm-hmm.
They send in additional comments. So the six words come usually with some sort of essay. And then beyond that, they often will send in pictures or artifacts. And so it's become this really interesting archive of people's thoughts about this really difficult subject. And it's an opportunity to observe. It's an opportunity to eavesdrop. And it's an opportunity to learn, because if you are afraid to enter that conversation, this is a space where you can do it and sort of learn a little bit before you figure out how you might want to personally engage. You can listen before you actually have to participate in the dialogue in an active way.
Right, and it's very thought-provoking. And you have people participating, people of all skin colors. You have things like, jotted down a few of them, "I live to remember their names." And then the further explanation is, "The names I remember every day are those of the 45 black people held in bondage by my maternal ancestors from the 1670s, Boston, down to the antebellum Louisiana." But then you also have this other one juxtaposed with it, "Hated for being a white cop." And then the further explanation on that one, Michelle, is, "As a young, naive police officer," I think this is from a Texas, the contributor here, "as a young, naive police officer, I mistakenly thought most people would appreciate my sincere desire to help and protect the citizens of my community. I was shocked to find out that some people, who didn't even know my name, background, or what was in my heart, hated the very sight of me only because I was a white police officer."
We've heard from more than a few white police officers who've sent in similar sentiments, that people make all kinds of judgments about them, usually not very friendly, just based on the combination of the color of their skin and the uniform that they wear. On the other hand, we've also heard from black or Latino cops who say that, you know, when they're not in uniform, people make assumptions about them. You know, other cops might not recognize that they're a fellow police officer. So it's really interesting. One of the things that I realized, I call it the Race Card Project, which suggests that it's really about identity based on skin color. A lot of the submissions, if you go deep and, you know, really scroll through the submissions, are about identity of one kind or another, but it's not even always about skin color. You know, sometimes it's about your ethnic origin, where your family immigrated from. I have a bunch of submissions about red hair. From the people who are in the military, who find that when they return to civilian life, that they have a hard time trying to segue back into a society because they feel that their experiences set them apart. And so that's the sort of framework through which they see their own identity. So if I were going to do it again, I'm not even sure I would call it the Race Card Project. I don't know what I would call it, but right. It really is sort of American ID as an identity.
Here's one that doesn't play off of skin color from the Race Card Project. The six words being, "My name is being made fun of?" ? And it's submitted by someone in New York named Bang Ang. "People often make jokes about my name. They would ask, 'Did your parents drop pots and pans or something? Did your mom drop her spoon at the hospital to name you that way?' This made me feel very depressed and feel bad about being Chinese."
Right. And someone who you wonder if you kind of can't imagine someone saying that, and you assume that if it was said, it was said in jest. "Oh, did your mom drop a pot or pan?" I mean, that's kind of, you know, you can understand why a statement like that would sting. But you wonder if they felt in the moment that they could challenge that or question that.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how the wall is full of people who often think, "Boy, if only I could have said that." You know how you have that moment, you kick yourself in the shower, you,
yep.
You know, you hit your forehead and think, "Oh, I should have said this." You know, you think of all the great things that you should have said. And sometimes people do, you know, express themselves in that way. And sometimes they do it in the hope that someone who might think about uttering a statement like that might come upon their card and maybe think twice about making a joke like that, even if it isn't jest, to just think a little bit about how that might hit someone else's ear.
If you just joined us, my guest is Michelle Norris, NPR host and special correspondent, creator of the Race Card Project. And tell people how people can participate, Michelle, before we talk a little more.
Well, if you visit the website, you can there is a form that you can send in your own six words and additional comments if you like. A lot of people submit via Twitter, and they use just the hashtag, the Race Card Project. We have many, many submissions that come in that way. And then people still send in the actual cards. These began with these little black postcards where I asked people to write down their six-word thoughts. And if you were part of a group, for instance, if you're a teacher and you wanted to use it in the classroom, or if you were in a church group and you wanted to use it at an institution, you can contact us, and we can actually send you packets. It's like almost like a race card in a box. Mm-hmm. And you can use that to either stoke or capture a dialogue in a particular environment.
I think it's very interesting, Michelle, that you said that if you were to do it again, you would not sure you would name it the Race Card Project, because it seems bigger than race. It tells me this is unexpected. What dimensions of this specifically have been the biggest surprises for you?
The whole thing has been a surprise. When I first printed those 200 cards, I really didn't know if anybody would send them back. And much to my surprise, about 30% of the initial 200 cards I printed came back to me. So that let me know, wow, there's something here. People might be ready for this conversation. And so the numbers surprise me. The candor surprises me. The way that people make connections, and you can see people either on Twitter or in the comment stream engaging in dialogue, and not all of it is easy stuff. I mean, if you spent time on the site, you'll see the comments can sometimes be a little bit prickly. In fact, they can be very prickly. And if you go to the website, I can guarantee you that you are going to be confronted with something that will make you uncomfortable, something that will make you squirm.
Are those comments moderated in any way?
They're moderated, but there are things that I leave on the site that I know will make people uncomfortable, and I sometimes struggle with that. But if this is to be a portal into the honest conversation about race, it means that conversation is going to take you to uncomfortable places, because that's the reality of race, is that, you know, people have lots of different views, and many of them are not, you know, considered kosher by everybody, or by, you know, one group as opposed to the other. So the level of candor and the conversation that grows out of that has surprised me also. And also the connections people make. I mean, we now do these segments on the radio. For the past year, we've been doing Race Card segments on Morning Edition. And they've been rich and wonderful and robust conversations. And many times we find that the comment stream that flows out of that, you think you're writing about one thing, and then so many people hear something within those stories that connects with them. There's a piece that we did, her six words were, Mexican white girl doesn't speak Spanish. And after that piece aired, we heard from so many people who lamented the fact that they didn't learn Russian, they didn't learn Italian, they didn't learn how to speak German, usually because their parents so badly wanted them to become American, whatever that meant. And so they wanted them to grow up speaking English, and speaking English perfectly, and not with an immigrant's tongue. And so they didn't teach them a particular language. And years later, much like Alicia, the woman who wrote those initial six words, Mexican white girl doesn't speak Spanish, they really regretted not being able to connect with other members of their family, not being able to fully connect with their culture. And so we did a piece that we really thought was about the experience of being Latino in America and being of Mexican descent in particular. And it turned out that so many people heard something within those six words that spoke directly to them, even though they themselves were not Latino.
So you're looking for broad themes that a lot of these entries or contributions share.
Well, you know, I don't know that we're necessarily looking for them. I mean, but people find them, and it reminds us that sometimes the things that divide us, you know, that we focus on the things that divide us, but within that, there are many things that unite us,
right?
As well.
Mm-hmm. Where do you want this to go? It's been a surprising journey. How many years has it been going?
3 years, mm-hmm. over 3 years.
Where does it go from here? Where do you want to take it?
Well, I hope that, you know, it will continue to be a receptacle and a place that stokes dialogue. I hope that it will continue to be a wonderful content well for public radio, and we can continue to dip into that and to share those stories with our listeners. In the long run, Kiefer, I hope it is an archive that will be of use to people years from now. I know that this period that we're living in will be examined and explored in all kinds of ways by journalists, by historians, by researchers of all kinds, not just because there is a man of color living in the White House, but also because of the great demographic changes that we're going through and the technological changes that we're going through. In many ways, as a nation, we're kind of mid-turn, you know, the page is turning for lots and lots of reasons. And this archive with all of these stories that represent every state and so many corners of every state and now more than 50 countries around the world will hopefully be a wonderful resource. And I just have to figure out where that archive can live so it will be of use to people decades from now.
Now, this project, the Race Card Project, grew out of, as I mentioned, the memoir titled The Grace of Silence that you wrote in 2010. And it was a way to explore your family's history, things you didn't know about your family, but also they said something about the American experience or the experience of black people in America in this case. I wonder if we could end this conversation by having you share a story or two from that memoir and perhaps going to the Midwestern site where you grew up, Minneapolis, about how it was hard for your parents to buy a house in the neighborhood you wanted.
Well, my family, we lived in the far south side of Minneapolis, and in our particular neighborhood, we were the first black family to buy a house at Far South on Oakland Avenue. And immediately when they purchased their house, every neighbor, and since everybody in the neighborhood was white, they were all white neighbors, every neighbor whose property line touched ours promptly put their houses up for sale. And my neighborhood that I remember as I got older was integrated, and I learned that the neighborhood was integrated because my parents integrated it. They were the blockbusters, is I guess the term that they often used. And the neighborhood changed over time. Those who stayed developed friendships with my parents. The kids all went to school. We developed friendships. Those who couldn't sell their houses sometimes wound up developing relationships and friendships, probably grudgingly at first. But the neighborhood evolved. It evolved. And one of the things that I found in doing research about this was this pamphlet that the state of Minnesota under Governor Anderson published, and it was called The Negro in Your Neighborhood.
And what year is this?
That was it would have been a few years before my family purchased their house. It was in the late 1950s. And it was this pamphlet that they published because families were going through the similar experience that we were going through. They were moving into neighborhoods. They were integrating neighborhoods. And it's this incredible document that talked about, incredible from you know, this vantage point, looking back from the year 2014, it talked about being neighborly. And they had to explain that when black families moved into previously white neighborhoods, that those families usually moved in those neighborhoods for the same reasons as everyone else. They wanted nice housing. They wanted good schools. It explained that these are families that know how to take care of their houses, which is when you read it, you kind of go, oh, they had to explain that, but apparently they did at that time. And at the end, there's only a few copies of this apparently that are circulating, but I'm glad that I was able to secure one because it really is interesting. But at the end, they talked about having not all that long ago, having participated in a war. World War II, and I guess also the Korean War, it would have been at the time, where the United States was involved in a fight for democracy and the fight to uphold principles that were dear to this nation. And they talked about the Minnesota way. I grew up in Minnesota, a neighboring state. And that to uphold those principles those principles that we fought for in order to uphold those principles, people had to really think about being neighborly and opening and being open to the kind of change that my parents represented. So it was, you know, through this whole journey, I've learned a lot about my own personal family history, but I've also ended up learning a lot about America. And I encourage people to engage in these conversations about diversity and multiculturalism and race, not because I want to wallow in what America used to be and how difficult it used to be under segregation, but hopefully that people will understand how we have evolved as a country. And when you really recognize that, you know, not that long ago, things were so incredibly different, it is very hard when you fully understand that to take for granted the America that we live in today.
Mm-hmm. And finally, Michelle, I wanted to get your thoughts on this because, as you just described, growing up in Minneapolis and that story of moving into a white neighborhood, beginning of the integration in that particular Minneapolis neighborhood, having grown up in that time as a young girl and having watched our country evolve in this area for years, how do the civil rights struggles of the 1960s and beyond of blacks compare in your mind with the change that is going on in this country now in recent years about the rights of, say, same-sex couples? Is that also reflected in your race card project?
Oh, yes, very much so, very much so. And, you know, America is ever-evolving. And as I think about the history lessons that I learned in school, for instance, and how much of them focused on revolutions of one kind or another. And we don't pay as much attention to evolutions and how we evolve, and the fact that we do evolve. You know, if you think about, I mean, look at whether you look at polling on gay marriage or whether you just look around and people's attitudes and how open people are to things that they were very calcified about just a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of incredible how quickly that happened. And it's incredible that it happened. You know, and I think that's probably one of the strengths of this country is that we are malleable, that we do grow and stretch and evolve. And one of the other things about this country that is incredible, I think, is that even if you are on the losing side of those battles, people figure out how to remain within the fabric of America. I realize that when I researched the other part of my family story, where my father was originally from in Birmingham, you know, there are a lot of people who didn't want these changes. There are people today who still don't want these changes. But we don't see the kind of revolutions that you see in other places. You don't see the kind of social unrest that you see in many other places around the world. And that's part of the beauty of America, is that we live in a place where people can evolve, but people can also disagree with each other and still figure out how to occupy the same space.
NPR host, special correspondent, and creator of the Race Card Project, Michelle Norris, thank you for this conversation. You'll be talking about the Race Card Project at Coe College in Cedar Rapids tomorrow at 7:30 in Sinclair Auditorium. Thank you so much for this conversation, Michelle.
Thank you. Great to be with you again.
Coming up after a short break, broadcast journalist Soledad O'Brien. O'Brien is the 2014 Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Distinguished Lecturer at the University of Iowa. I'll ask her about the fact that her parents had to leave Maryland, where they lived, in 1958 to get married. That was due to the state's laws against interracial marriage. Soledad O'Brien, a conversation with her coming up in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour is award-winning television journalist Soledad O'Brien. O'Brien was the 2014 Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Distinguished Lecturer at the University of Iowa. That took place in late January. In March of 2013, O'Brien left her daily journalism gig with CNN and started her own production company, Starfish Media Group. And since then, O'Brien has been working on a range of projects, from producing documentaries for CNN to being a special correspondent for Al Jazeera America. She joins us now by phone. Soledad O'Brien, what a great pleasure to have you on our program. Welcome.
Thank you very much. The pleasure's all mine.
Your mother emigrated from Cuba. Your father is from Australia.
And diversity in the media was the topic of your lecture at the University of Iowa. What was the thrust of that message?
You know, I really wanted to talk about some of the personal experiences I've had as a journalist coming up, gosh, for the last now 26 years working in television news, both local stations and network, and then to cable. But also really talking about how the changing demographics of America, I think, require us to think about sort of the content that we put on television, not just in who's in front of the camera, certainly, which I think gets a lot of focus, but also the way we tell stories and the kinds of stories we want to tell. We had a lot of success at CNN and even at NBC, sort of really looking at diverse groups and having an opportunity to tell very nuanced, thoughtful, textured stories. And I think some days in television news that's lost. The good news is there's a lot of new, you know, outlets and opportunities to do a better job on those stories. But the more the nation becomes diverse, I think there's certainly more of an interest in having these kinds of stories.
When you look at those, now that you've kind of broken it up into different segments, we're talking about the people in front of the camera. You are in front of the camera, but there are also people behind the scenes, decision makers behind the scenes. And then also you mentioned the topic. So of those three things, and perhaps there are other aspects that I'm overlooking, where are we doing well in terms of diversity and where are we doing less well?
I'd say meh on in front of the camera. I think certainly that's in every station I've ever worked. There's probably the most input on that, where people really think about the face of the network and the station. But at the end of the day, you and I both know that the real power is kind of many layers up when you really are thinking about the kinds of stories and who's going to tell those stories and what sorts of issues you're going to tackle and how they're going to be tackled. Those decisions are actually made at quite a high level. You know, they don't. It takes a while to trickle down even to the person who's going to be anchoring or reporting the coverage. You know, there are several meetings that happen first, and so I think it's really a misnomer to think of, well, there's a lot of diverse faces on camera, ergo everything must be hunky-dory. I think you have to look at all those categories and really assess them equally. Mm-hmm. Certainly when you're looking at leadership, we have not seen a tremendous strides in the diverse face at the high executive producer, vice president, and higher levels. I think when you're looking at the material, I mean, we found, I think that category really differs depending on what network you're looking at and what station you're looking at. We found tremendous success in the stories that we were telling, whether it was Latino in America, gay in America, Muslim in America. And the interesting thing was it you didn't have to try to just capture that audience that would be interested, that there was this theory that people in general are interested about a changing world.
Mm-hmm. So when that upper echelon of people gets more diverse, how will the programming change for consumers?
Well, you know, I think that you won't have, I mean, certainly from my personal experience, you had a lot of fighting to get stories on. You know, it's going to completely determine what sorts of stories are covered. How many crews do you send to cover a story? Do you go back to cover Haiti's, you know, first anniversary and second anniversary? Or do you say, listen, people really aren't interested. We just don't care about this story anymore. Let's move on. You know, that's literally where those decisions are made.
We know that the election of Barack Obama in 2008 did not usher in a post-racial society. But I wonder, Soledad O'Brien, I wonder how you think it has shaped our society in the, I guess, 5 years that President Obama has been president.
Oh, I think it's shaped it in lots of ways. I think certainly there's this idea of, you know, what the face of an American president looks like, what the face of a first lady in the United States looks like, and certainly President Obama and every subsequent president will have this, and first lady will have this opportunity to kind of say, this is what a president can look like, which I think actually is incredibly inspiring to people. If you ever have a, you know, female president, suddenly it's like, this is what an American president can look like.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone sort of recalibrates like, oh, okay, this is what is possible. So I think that it's had a very big impact. I never was one who believed that, you know, we're going to be post-racial the minute you elect a black president, certainly, and I don't know a lot of people who with great seriousness ever thought that. I think what has been really good is that there have been a lot of very blunt conversations about race and where we are today, and some of them are very icky and nasty. But I do think the conversation has moved to the forefront. I mean, there's a, you know, even the Super Bowl when Coke ran an ad with sort of everybody, you know, singing America the Beautiful in a different language. You know, some of the responses were just incredibly hateful and also bizarrely inaccurate with people saying, you know, this is our national anthem, white. I'm like, well, not really. It's America the Beautiful. It's not our national anthem. You know, but a lot of it I thought was just incredibly hateful and racist, that somehow people singing America the Beautiful in another language was considered vile and disgusting. I mean, it was really, in some ways, very upsetting. And yet, I think that the only way to confront those kinds of issues is to continue to have those kinds of conversations. You have to, you know, shine a little light on the topic and then have a discussion about it.
In recent news, several weeks back, we had the controversy, and some say overreported, of Fox News host Megyn Kelly saying that Santa Claus is white, of course, and so is Jesus, by the way. What did that remark, in reaction to a Salon.com column and the controversy it set off, tell you about our attitudes towards race today?
Was really interesting about that was the way in which Megyn Kelly was very happy to say, of course he's white, right? Because her perspective is that. And I think it was just a very, I mean, of course, in her family, I'm sure Santa's white. You know, she grew up with a white Santa. Her grandparents grew up with a white Santa. They had a white Santa. And it just means that your perspective is very limited. You know, you obviously don't know anybody who, you know, has a black Santa or has a brown Santa. I mean, that, you know, clearly most of the friends who I have who are black, in their minds, to their children, Santa is black. Santa is undeniably black.
And Soledad O'Brien, what color was your Santa growing up?
So I never really thought of Santa being a color. I thought Santa was bringing presents. It's funny because I really spent a lot of time asking my kids about that. Like, what color do you think Santa is? And they're like, Mom, we don't really believe that much in Santa. But Santa delivers presents to our house, and everybody's happy with Santa. But I guess, to me, I've always been a big believer that Santa's any color you want him to be, you know, and Jesus can be any color that you want him to be in your head. If you're looking for historical accuracy, I think you can trace back the roots of Jesus enough to figure out what he probably would look like. I think what was most upsetting about that was this idea, like, no, the perspective is this. This is how I feel. This is what must be true. And it's just an indication for a lot of people whose perspective is constantly left out. You know, that there was no even nod to, not everybody feels this way. We all have a different perspective on this. It was just, listen, if you think differently, you're wrong. Santa is this. And I think that's why, I mean, you know, it became such a little bit of a hot button issue for her.
If you just joined us, my guest is award-winning television journalist Soledad O'Brien. She was the 2014 Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Distinguished Lecturer at the University of Iowa, and that took place in late January. Soledad, no doubt, got a good dose of some Midwestern cold weather, I guess, huh, Soledad?
I've been having a lot of East Coast cold weather myself, so it's no big deal.
You've covered the Iowa caucuses, Soledad. What stands out for you about covering that event, which,
Iowa caucuses. You know why? Because it really signals, for journalists who cover politics, the beginning of the race. I mean, of course, right now, we're already talking about 2016, so in theory, the race has already begun. But really, to me, the Iowa caucus is the flag down, here we go, the race is now on in earnest, and I find it very fascinating. So, you know, I think every time you're covering, you're re-entering and gearing up for an election season, it's really the Iowa caucuses that kind of make you start thinking about, you know, now we're knee-deep in it.
I want to have us listen to some audio from your former show on CNN, Starting Point. In fact, it's from the Tuesday morning on caucus day, January 3rd, 2012, just over 2 years ago. And here you were interviewing Republican presidential hopeful Michelle Bachmann from our neighboring state of Minnesota, and you got into a bit of a tussle with her.
You have taken a lot of flack for some of your very strong social issues, where you stand on them, and I want to talk about some of them. Your stance on homosexuality, and I want to read a little bit of what you said. You said at Educators Conference in 2004, gays live a very sad life, and that it's part of Satan. That's a quote. And you've taken a lot of flack for that. Do you pull back on any of that?
You know, it's just a bizarre thing to bring up today. Today is the election, and what people recognize as the most important issue that people will be looking at is, who is the best person to deal with the economy? Probably someone who's created a business from scratch. I came from a family where I was below poverty. I had to earn my way up out of poverty.
What you're telling me is you don't want to discuss social issues because you want to talk about the economy. I don't think it's a bizarre question. I think it's a fair question.
Well,
you're wanting to be president.
It's a gotcha question coming way out of the past. I stand very strong for marriage between one man and one woman. I believe in protecting human life from conception until natural death. I believe in the family. I believe in religious liberty, and for people to be able to practice their faith freely. That's important. But it's also important that we get rid of Obamacare.
It's Soledad O'Brien. That's some audio from January 3rd, Caucus Day 2012, talking with Michelle Bachmann, who was a presidential hopeful there. What do you remember about that interview?
Oh, gosh, we did so many. I think that what I try to do when someone says to me that that's a bizarre question is really to answer the point that they're making. And I think when you're starting off so early in an election season, you're being judged on a lot of things. I mean, what you saw was a classic political pivot, right, which is I'm not going to answer that question. Mm-hmm. I'm not even going to even think about answering that question. I'm going to talk about the thing that I'd like to pitch, which is the economy. I mean, I think that's kind of typical, you know, politics and politician 101. I don't think it was a bizarre question. I think that obviously we certainly know from polling, and we know how that election ended up overall, was that social issues play a huge role, and the economy plays a huge role. And looking at the numbers of where the economy is coming back or not coming back was also very big. I mean, we watched them literally month to month as we entered the election year. So all of those things are on the table. I think that sometimes, really often, politicians sort of posit this idea that there are only certain things that you can mm-hmm. ask, and that's just absolutely not true. And I think once you realize that someone has created this false sense of, well, that's out of the lane, you have to decide, well, is it or not? I certainly don't think so if you're running to be president of the United States.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is your technique for nailing down the slippery politicians from whatever party?
You know, I think it's about really reading their own words. I mean, in a way, you know, when you take someone's own words and you read them back to them, it allows them to either stand by them or distance themselves, which I thought was kind of interesting. In that particular case, she didn't say, I never said that. And she didn't say, listen, I agree still. Mm-hmm. I think gays live a sad life. She did not say that.
She
sort of did the I'm not going to answer, which I think is problematic that early in an election season. I don't think you can start off with the I'm not going to dignify that question. I think it's always about going back to the primary source material. I think it's about really understanding sort of the question that needs to be asked. Sometimes people who are so in the beltway kind of get caught up in the tit for tat. Oh, my gosh, you know, Boehner said this, and then Harry Reid said that, and then, you know, and as opposed to the actual question. And over the last year, there's certainly been these great moments where you could push politicians on the left and on the right, you know, about what they said compared to what they're doing, compared to what they're protesting, compared to what they've said in the past. I mean, tons of opportunity. And sometimes I fear that we just, as journalists, don't do that enough.
You, Soledad O'Brien, are known for a contentious interview style. We heard it there a little bit. You told Politico.
I'm going to argue with you on
that.
Okay,
again, go ahead.
I think that's just because, and maybe by arguing with you, I'm confirming.
Yeah, okay.
But really, I don't think that's contentious. I think that's being a good journalist.
Okay.
And I remember every time someone would review one of my interviews, they'd say, Soledad grills, there's a smackdown, and it's like, it's just a smart question. This woman who would like to be president has said this and this on the record about homosexuals. I think she should answer to that. Would be great to talk about the economy, too, and we certainly had her on enough to talk about a lot of issues. But, you know, so I guess I would argue that anytime you come well prepared and you ask people about things that they've said on the record in the past, you sort of get people saying, oh, you're contentious, you're aggressive. Yeah, that's our job. I'm supposed to ask her questions so that people understand the person that they're potentially electing.
Mm-hmm. What is the thrill for you in this type of interview? What's the thrill for you personally?
You know, I don't think there's some huge thrill outside of, in general, in journalism. I think anytime you do a job well, if you feel like you're prepared, if I had read a quote to her and she had said back to me, you know, I never said that, you're misquoting me, you're wrong. I mean, that would be horrifying, right? Because that's a failure of journalism. We very rarely made those kinds of mistakes. We were really quite careful and really aggressive in accuracy on that front. Mm-hmm. So where you're, you know, horrified is when you journalistically make a mistake. You're journalistically wrong. That's terrible. I don't think there's some big thrill. I think it's the same thing you do when you go and you cover a story well. You feel like, okay, you know, I did a solid interview. She gave me solid responses back, and now we've moved the ball forward in terms of, you know, the vetting process for somebody who'd like to be president. I think that that's sort of always the job.
Soledad O'Brien, let's pivot quickly back to combine the Iowa caucus coverage that you've done with your topic that you spoke about in Iowa, diversity. Now, given the fact that Iowa is one of the least diverse states in the nation, Don't you think there's a better place? There are better places that better reflect the diversity of our country as a whole to hold the first in the nation test of presidential candidates every 4 years.
Well, that's an issue that comes up, right, every 4 years. Everyone has that exact same conversation, and everybody wrings their hands and says, oh, my gosh, what is this even proving? You know,
yeah.
I don't think it's going to change in the very near future. And I think it is an interesting point. I mean, again, America's becoming more and more diverse. I think it's interesting. I mean, I think that these races are very interesting, and every step of the way, it's a real vetting process for someone. I mean, it's grueling. You follow these presidential candidates, and you realize just how grueling it is. But I don't, you know, I don't mind. I never felt that there had to be this kind of, you know, let's get what America looks like. As we know, America is very diverse. In some places, it's completely homogeneous. In other places, it's very diverse.
Right.
So I don't know that you're ever going to find one place that is the perfect representation of the nation. Or should you? You know, I think Iowa is amazing. I mean, the fact that people are so, you know, interested in the caucus system, particularly, I think just fascinating how just, you know, interested people are in their local politics. I think that's phenomenal. So I've always really liked covering the caucuses, and I don't think it necessarily is, you know, looks anything like Manhattan where I live, but that's okay. You know, it's America's is very diverse, even in its diversity.
Solon, Dad, I hope you don't mind if I want to ask, I want to find out a little bit more about your parents. I understand that before they were married, your parents lived in Maryland. This is 1958. And when they wanted to get married, they had to move to a place where interracial marriage was legal?
That's correct. Although they didn't move, they just drove to Washington, D.C., where interracial marriage was legal. And then after their ceremony, went back to Baltimore, where interracial marriage was illegal, and in 16 other states as well.
Was their marriage then back in Baltimore recognized?
You know, they were able to live as a married couple, so I suppose their marriage was recognized, although it was not possible for another couple who was living in Maryland to be married if they were an interracial couple.
Well, let's talk a little bit about our media in general and about Starfish Media. First of all, our news media has become politically polarized in recent years. Conservative Fox News Network, the liberal MSNBC News Network. Many of our listeners would not have watched Al Jazeera, and your media group, Starfish Media, does work with Al Jazeera. So how would you describe Al Jazeera's approach to journalism in the United States when you compare it with what we have out there right now, CNN, Fox, MSNBC?
You know, what I think that they are trying to do is do a lot of what CNN was doing maybe 25 years ago. I think the news is the star, is what Ted Turner used to always say. And as an anchor woman, that was always problematic. Right? But I think what he was trying to say was that it's about the story and how do we figure out how to tell the most relevant and important stories. And it's not about the loudest screamer who's shouting insults back and forth in the drama. It's about really trying to dig into a story. I can only talk about the pieces that I've had an opportunity to do. I contribute to Al Jazeera America. I contribute to HBO. I do some projects for National Geographic. I do docs for CNN. So I work for a lot of folks, and I think what I have found really great about the pieces that I've done for Al Jazeera is that they're serious journalism with a capital J. We just did a 20-minute segment on education and looking at people who hop borders, sort of district borders, in order to get their kids a better chance in a better school, and kind of the reasons why that exists in the United States, that kind of structure where your property taxes fund your school base, and also, you know, what can be done about it, what is happening with people who are jumping the borders, including two people who we talked to who, you know, one was in prison, the other faced criminal charges. So I think it's, you know, fascinating. I don't know that I'd ever be able to go someplace else and do a 20-minute look at what is a really interesting issue in education, which ultimately is about inequity in education, which is a big deal today.
One last question, if I might,
sure.
Soledad. Is it true that Jesse Jackson once told you don't count as a black?
You know, he said to me, I wrote about it in my memoir now a couple of years ago, but he was talking about, you know, he grabbed the top of my hand and basically said, yeah, he didn't think that, you know, the issues that he was dealing with, he was saying, were not the issues that I deal with because of my skin tone, that, you know, I don't count. I might, you know, and I was very hurt. I was very upset. And, you know, years later we talked about it. And we had a real discussion about it, and we certainly cleared the air about it. But absolutely, and he's not certainly not the first person who's had this idea that, that you know, if you are light-skinned, black in this country, and they're right, you have a very different set of experiences than people who are dark-skinned African-Americans. I mean, that everyone knows that. So I think that, you know, I don't know that I would say I don't count, because I think everybody brings their experiences to sort of what they're currently working on and trying to process and work through and bring to the fore. But he certainly, I think, said something that that it was really a challenge for me. How do you tell these stories about all people, people who often don't get coverage, whose perspectives aren't seen? I thought, you know, as much as it was very hurtful and we later really cleared the air, yeah, I think he, you know, that's what he meant. You don't count.
Award-winning television journalist Soledad O'Brien, thank you so much for this conversation. I've appreciated it so much.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
O'Brien, the 2014 Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Distinguished Lecturer at the University of Iowa, that took place in January.
And that's River to River for today. Our program is produced by Ben Stanton, Emily Woodbury, and Sarah Bowden. Tune in tomorrow, Politics Day. Our executive producer, Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.